This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the morning shower to brushing and flossing, doing the laundry, loading the dishwasher, our daily routines are marked by efforts to avoid germs. While it's fairly obvious why we do it, the cumulative effect of germ avoidance is less apparent. A group of evolutionary biologists propose that such avoidance is extremely significant. In fact, they theorize that cultures across the world have been largely shaped by the struggle to avoid disease. Here with more is Ethan Waters. He wrote about some of those biologists in an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All Your Most Cherished Beliefs, which was published in Pacific Standard. Ethan Waters, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
In the article, you profile the evolutionary biologist Randy Thornhill primarily and his pathogen stress theory. This is a potentially paradigm-shifting theory of human behavior. Can you summarize it for us?
He's really swinging for the fences with this one, for sure. This is the idea that we have psychological mechanisms that bring us to avoid diseases. You know, and as you said, you could see that on a sort of daily basis. But his theory is that these mechanisms over time in culture have an enormous effect on things that we wouldn't necessarily think they would have an effect on, like what sort of government you have, whether you have a group that is interdependent or a group that values independence. And the idea is that certain places in the world, you have higher disease loads. And because of that, you tend to go towards behavior that would, say, favor your in-group or keep outsiders at bay because you would have developed immune resistance to the diseases around you, but maybe not to the ones that over the hill. So you tend to have these sort of social structures that get going under the pressure of disease. And alternatively, in other places where there's a lower disease threat, you have a different set of evolutionary pressures that allow for perhaps more independent thinking, more trade with other people because you don't have those disease loads, which leads to another set of cultural sort of behaviors that have an effect generation after generation that lead to other outcomes, like in Thornhill's theories, democracies in one place, autocratic governments in another place, higher religious displays in certain places, more cultural diversity in some places and less so in other places.
Okay, so that's a big load of things out there. Part of the breakdown that Thornhill does is looks at things regionally, and it seems to me sort of determined by climate. This is something that's been done before. You know, there seems to be more democratically run societies in the northern hemisphere and fewer in the global south. What does climate have to do with this?
Right. So climate, in places where it's warm and wet, you know, traditionally, certainly over time, you've had higher disease loads. So you have the malaria, you have the dengue fever, you have really pernicious and ongoing disease threats. And this is because that certain bugs, you know, need certain climate elements to sort of survive. So in certain places of the world, there's no doubt that traditionally there has been higher disease loads. And the theory is that when that happens, you tend to do a number of things within your culture. You tend to keep outsiders more away. You tend to invest in your in-group more. And that would lead potentially to more sort of patriarchal societies, more traditional societies, societies where custom is really held tightly to. And the idea is that when you move away from those zones, the opposite thing happens.
Mm-hmm. So you become more xenophobic in places where there is, what, a heavier pathogen load? Is that the way he puts it?
Exactly. Where disease is always around you, you tend to invest in your in-group. You tend to marry in. You tend to keep outsiders at bay. And when you do that generation after generation, you tend to create social structures, religions that reinforce this, governments that reinforce this, and social values and behaviors and things that we think are sort of most central to our beliefs about the world. Thornhill believes comes from these disease avoidance behaviors over time.
Well, you know, Ethan, I was just sort of observing myself on a plane about a week ago when someone was sneezing next to me, and this sort of like moment of revulsion and disgust and fear, you know, reeling back, thinking that you might get sick. I understand that on a kind of visceral level. discarding our waste, you know, away from our homes, avoiding sick people, not handling the dead. These are examples that we have actually in the natural world. Where do we find those?
Absolutely. I mean, human cultures have, you know, we have all sorts of ways of avoiding disease, and we tend to think of it as just sort of a natural reaction, and we tend to think of it as not affecting our values about the world. But there's another set of researchers up in British Columbia who've actually done sort of experiments, basically very similar to the one you just had on the plane, where they'll cue people to a disease threat, and then they will ask them questions about whether the government should give money to help immigrants from a foreign country. And after they've been cued with that disease threat, their values tend to shift significantly on that exact topic. People that have been cued to the threat of disease will be more likely to say, well, actually, we shouldn't give money to help those people come from that foreign country. Whereas the people that weren't given the disease condition were more likely to express more liberal values. The reason that the liberal values come about when there's less disease in Thornhill's theory is that the ways we defend against diseases are actually evolutionary kind of costly. To keep outsiders at bay means you're not trading with other people. It means you're not spreading your genetic material in other areas because you're not mating with other people. When that disease threat goes away, the theory goes, you tend to go away from those costly behaviors. You tend to trade more. You tend to marry out groups more. The trade leads to increased wealth. Wealth can lead to increased education. Education can lead to things like, you know, democracies and land ownership and so forth like that. So you have this sort of cycle that goes on in the lower disease regions where you give up these sort of costly ways of keeping diseases at bay.
We're talking about pathogen stress theory, a potentially paradigm-shifting theory that can help explain human behavior and culture and how it developed in certain societies. The idea has been put forward and tested by an evolutionary biologist named Randy Thornhill and one named Corey Fincher. We're speaking with Ethan Waters, who wrote about their work for Pacific Standard Magazine. How does it extend to this idea of, whether or not you're a democratic or a dictatorship type of political structure? What does it mean in terms of religion and belief and personal beliefs?
Well, many of these things like religion can in part be seen as displays of group membership. So the idea behind religion is that if you live in a place where you really need to know who's in my group and who's in that other group, and you need to know that because that other group might have a disease that you haven't developed a resistance to. So there are places in the world where there's really a patchwork of diseases. Even a similar disease will have different enough genetic material from one town to the next that will make that a threat to you, even if you have a resistance to your local disease. So if you live in a place like that, you need a way to display when someone walks down the road towards you, whether that person is in your group or not in your group. And religion, in one level, can be seen as a display of group membership. And so if you need a very, very micro way of understanding who's in your group and who's not, you tend to develop religious displays that are very dramatic, that make it very clear who's in your group and who's not, as with things like dress and cultural customs, dialects, and so on. You develop this patchwork of cultures so that you can tell I'm different from the person just down the road, because you need to know that because of this disease avoidance behavior. That's how the theory goes.
How did they test their hypothesis?
Well, basically, they're dealing with large data sets at this point. So one of the things that they're not doing is basically going and observing this on a very local level. There is data on whether societies are collectivists or individualists. There's data on whether societies are democratic or not. There's data about those religious subgroups and so forth. And they'll take that data set, and then they'll take data sets about disease prevalence and put them together and see if they can make a correlation between higher disease prevalence, say, and patriarchal systems, or higher disease prevalence and high religiosity and so forth. And they're finding this very a significant correlation. Of course, one of the criticisms of the disease of the theory is that correlations that don't actually make causation, and they have gotten some criticism from jumping too quickly from, oh, we have a correlation here, then we must have the cause. There's a remarkable amount of evidence out there on this. It is not just, you know, some graduate student's theory. There's significant research out there, but this is still early days for this theory, and a whole lot more needs to be done in terms of understanding this connection between disease and culture.
Yeah, it does seem like painting with a pretty broad brush. This also, in some ways, could tip into a tricky territory of justifying xenophobia and ethnocentric behavior. How does Fincher and his colleagues address these kind of concerns?
Well, they've dealt, you know, being evolutionary psychologists, they've dealt with this thing before, and it's really a tricky thing for these people because they're looking for the fundamental motivations of human behavior, and that goes to sexual behavior, our values, our governments, and so forth, and they're looking for the evolutionary cues and the psychological mechanisms that might make our behavior understandable. In doing so, people often misread it as saying, oh, then that behavior is justifiable. If it's evolutionary, it must be okay, or we have to behave this way. And I don't think Thornhill and Fincher and none of the evolutionary theorists I've talked to actually make that case, but people hear it that way, which is very unfortunate because I think to understand these behaviors, to understand xenophobia and racism and so forth, we do need to know the psychological mechanisms that underlie them. And even if there are those mechanisms, that doesn't mean that we're locked into behaving that way, and it certainly doesn't justify any behavior. But I think the idea is if we understand this behavior better, we can mitigate it more. And if we understand, for instance, that, you know, health is behind a lowering of racism or lowering of xenophobia, I think we have some really interesting new ways of thinking about if you want to live in a world without xenophobia and racism, what we need to do next.
Ethan Waters, I want to thank you for helping us understand this better today. Thank you.
Oh, a pleasure.
Ethan Waters, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, Men's Journal, Details, Wired, and PRI's This American Life. He wrote an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All of Your Most Cherished Beliefs for Pacific Standard. You'll find a link to read that article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.